Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade, conversation hot. You need a fan. It's Legal Face Off, so step into the ring. No topic off limit, cause they gon' cover everything. Now check them out on Facebook and Twitter. Like and follow because we don't wanna miss ya. Introducing your host, Christina and Rich. Legal Face Off is about to begin.
Yeah. And we welcome you into Legal Face Off on WGN at WGNRadio.com. Here in the Tribune Tower, the Legal Eagles are in studio. Rich Lankoff and Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich. Per usual, plenty to get to. We'll talk about banning non-compete agreements, the right to Yelp law, and then a lawsuit filed on behalf of Tent City Homeless. But we start with former Governor Rod Blagojevich, and to do so, we welcome back Attorney Len Goodman, who represents former Governor Rod Blagojevich, LenGoodmanLawOffice.com. Welcome back, Len. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Len, you've been the ex-governor's appellate lawyer now for several years. This last week or so, we learned a lot about life behind bars for Rod Blagojevich through his interview with NBC locally here and also his interview with Chicago Magazine. Some of the things we learned were that his nickname in prison is Gov, that he keeps late hours, that he looks very fit, and he, in fact, is working out a lot. Before we get into the state of the appeal, was any of this that you read news to you? You know, you're close with the governor, you know him well. Anything in here that surprised you?
It doesn't surprise me that he's doing well and keeps a positive attitude because, that's been my experience with him. So, no, not really.
So how does he, for those of our listeners who did not have a chance to check out the interview, how is he spending his days and does he talk at all about what his life will be like post-incarceration?
You know, I'm probably the wrong person to ask because I think I caught one of the specials on Channel 5, and I've recorded them. I haven't watched them all, so I apologize.
All right, well, you know him well. I guess, do you speak to him? Do you actively work with him? Because you are working right now on the writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court of the United States. Most folks see that as the, you know, last legal chance that the ex-governor has. You know, certainly he's also, I think, hopeful that President Trump at some point will commute a sentence. But do you actively speak with him in preparation for your work before the Supreme Court?
Yes. I do speak to him pretty regularly. Maybe once a month.
Okay. So his legal case was obviously, you know, something he wanted to talk about. You've been on our show before talking about it. Could you give us sort of your thoughts on, again, it's a very elaborate, legal theory we understand, but in a few minutes, could you lay out for our listeners what your theory will be if the Supreme Court, or what your theory is in trying to get the Supreme Court, as our listeners probably know, you have to convince the Supreme Court that there is an issue worthy of their consideration. So what's your case at this point?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court is interested in political corruption cases and prosecutors overreaching and some of these statutes that can be interpreted so broadly that they could be used to target any politically unfavorable politician. So I think that's the concern. They have taken some political corruption cases recently. Blagojevich's case, I think, is probably more important than the other ones that they've taken, in a sense, because it's a pure politics case. Every other case that the Supreme Court has looked at has been cases involving elected officials who've tried to enrich themselves in office, and that's not Governor Blagojevich for all of his faults. He never tried to enrich himself. He never took money from his campaign fund. He never took gifts from supporters. He never had someone pay for his daughter's wedding or took a Ferrari or a Rolex watch. He was always incredibly careful. And, You know, he paid for his own Cubs tickets. He paid for his own clothes. So his case is pure politics. Basically, he's in prison for political deal-making and for political fundraising. And, you know, what I always tell people is, as an elected official, you don't have to take gifts from supporters. You don't have to take Rolex watches. You do have to make political deals, and you do have to fundraise. So his case affects every elected official that can't self-fund. And so that's why I think it's such an important case. The fact courts have commented over the years that the law is murky when it comes to this type of political deal making and campaign fundraising. What is legal? What is not? Where is the line?
And to that point, sorry to cut you off, but to that point, I think it's fair to say the Supreme Court, especially when it comes to corruption cases, and especially in the last 6 years, you know, there's four prominent cases that we can talk about if we had more time, but especially in the last 6 years, one when your client's been in jail, especially under Chief Justice Roberts, they like to fix murkiness, right? They like clarity. I think that's fair to say, you know, generally with the Supreme Court, but especially when it comes to a murky question like this. I mean, it is currently unclear, especially in the wake of the, you know, McDonnell case, which was unanimously overturned by the Supreme Court. McDonnell is the former Virginia governor who actually took campaign funds for personal gain. I think it's unclear today what elected officials can do, given that Blagojevich is serving, you know, 14 years for never enriching himself, as you say, while another governor is walking free when he actually took things for his own enrichment. So I think you're correct. Supreme Court is interested in clearing up what is, you know, clearly muddied waters.
Yeah, you said it very well. I think there's some irony there. That Blagojevich is serving the longest sentence, you know, in recent memory, handed out to a public official, and he never took cash bribes. He never enriched himself. So I do think there is a strong case to be made, and you're exactly right that the Supreme Court, that's their job, to fix murkiness in the law, to settle the law when there's some confusion. And there is great confusion in the law. The Seventh Circuit, you know, we would argue really didn't do its job in terms of looking at these jury instructions and what is the standard. And, you know, most elected officials that I talk to say, you know, tell me what the line is. You know, and I'm a believer in public financing of elections. I'm not a fan of money in politics. But, you know, if that's the system we have, Blagojevich didn't invent it, you know, but he was forced to operate in it. And, you know, his position has always been, tell me what the rules are and I'll follow them. And, you know, what he's tried to say at trial, although a lot of his defense was excluded, was that I understood the law. The last time the Supreme Court actually looked at a pure political fundraising case was 1991, a case called McCormick. Blagojevich was familiar with that case. He had been briefed about that case, and he tried to follow it as best he could. He wasn't allowed to tell the jury that, but that was basically his defense. And I've listened to every single tape recording. I put them on my iPod and spent, you know, when I first got this case, and just listened to hours and hours of his phone calls. And he did try, you know, it's pretty clear that he tried to follow the rules as he understood and tried to follow the McCormick case, which said you can't promise anyone anything. You can go out and raise funds from people that have business before you and that want something from you, but that is not illegal. But you cannot make them a promise, and you can't make a threat. And he never did that. So, and they put him in jail anyway. So, you know, it's really a warning to any elected official. If they can do this to Rod, I would argue they can do it to anyone.
So procedurally, what is next in the case? The writ is due in November, you said?
Correct.
Okay. And then for listeners, can you just sort of outline what comes after that?
Well, you file the petition, and you have a month after that to see if you can get any amicus support. You mentioned the Governor McDonald's case. He had a lot of important friends, and he had a lot of amicus help. I don't know if it was five or six briefs filed from very prominent people. So, you know, we're hoping to be able to get some support for Blagojevich because it is such an important issue. It's not necessarily people saying, we want Rod out of prison. It's people saying, yes, we agree the Supreme Court should clarify the law. It's murky. And so that's really the job that we have. And it is a sales job, really, for the Supreme Court to convince them that the law is murky and that this is the right case to take to settle the law.
Well, good luck, Len. I mean, you know, on this show, sometimes Tina and I try to be sort of objective reporters, but we also have opinions. I think that's fine. I mean, my opinion, I've made this very clear from day one with this case, is I think it's a complete overreach of federal authority. I can't believe that Blagojevich is still in jail 5.5 years later for this, when, you know, people like Jesse Jackson, you know, Denny Hastert, they received minuscule sentences compared to what Blagojevich was accused of. So good luck. You have our support here, or at least my support, and come back and tell us how it went.
Thank you.
That's Len Goodman, Len Goodman Law Offices, LenGoodmanLawOffice.com. Thanks, Len.
Okay, take care, guys. Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
You can follow Legal Face-Off on Facebook, on Twitter. Also, subscribe on iTunes. Search for Legal Face-Off. We love to have our guests in the studio when they can make it, and that's what Alan Mills came through with, the executive director at the Uptown People's Law Center. The website, uplcchicago.org. Thanks for coming in, Alan.
You're very welcome. Good to be here.
So, Alan, we understand you recently filed a case on behalf of activist Andy Thayer, who has been heading up the Uptown Tent City Organizers. The case involves a homeless community that is located at the viaducts at Lawrence and Wilson by Lakeshore Drive. Construction, I think, is set to start this week, if it hasn't already, to repair the crumbling concrete at the viaducts and to put in bike lanes. And it's scheduled to last until at least March of next year. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this case and the members of the community that have been impacted by the construction?
Sure. The case began when Andy Thayer applied for a permit to hold an assembly in front of an uptown school called Stort School, which is one of the 50 that was closed by our mayor a couple of years ago. It's been sitting there vacant. In front of that school is a pedestrian mall and a lot of grassy area. It's also right across the street from the alderman's office. So Mr. Thayer thought that would be an excellent place to put up tents, hold an assembly, put up protest signs to make sure that the city was well aware that we continue to have a homeless problem and it wasn't hidden away. The city rejected that application, saying it was illegal to pitch tents on the public way, despite the fact these tents had been under the viaducts for years. And that was the genesis of the federal court case. In the federal court case, we are alleging both that it's a violation of the First Amendment to deny them the right to put up tents and make this protest in that area, and a violation of the Eighth Amendment because criminalization of homelessness is a constitutional violation, is what we alleged.
Have those arguments been tested in court before, as far as you know, those two arguments?
Well, the First Amendment argument has a long history. Obviously, the First Amendment.
I think I've heard of the First Amendment, yes.
Right. It's been litigated for a very long time.
As it applies to, you know,
well, the question is whether
situations.
It's a time, place, or manner restriction, and the city's agreed that time and place is okay. The only question is manner. And there have been cases all over the country going different ways as to whether or not putting up a tent under what circumstances and in what location is, in fact, a reasonable manner restriction.
So how difficult is it to put forth those arguments while dealing with, you know, a constituency of people that don't have a lot of power, that sometimes don't have a lot of public support, you know, sometimes don't present as well as some litigants. Obviously, a lot of them have, you know, issues. How difficult or how much of a factor are those issues when it comes to, you know, trying to get them some rights?
I actually have not found any of those issues to be a problem. The clients that we've worked with under the viaducts are actually some of the sweetest, most cooperative clients that I have. So that has not been the problem. The bigger problem is one that there's a general hostility in this society towards people that are homeless. People like to run. People like to pretend that they don't exist.
And to that point, just I when I was watching the coverage of this, you know, I heard an interesting quote from one of your, it was either one of the organizers or a supporter. And like, it's so simple, but it makes you think, you know, there's two aspects to homeless person. It's homeless, but also person. You know, and that's really an interesting way, simple way of thinking about it. But, you know, you get so caught up on the homeless part without thinking about the people part of that term.
And from the Uptown People's Law Center's perspective, that's not hard at all. We actually have represented many of the people who are down there in other cases. Sometimes we represented them when they were still tenants in eviction cases. Sometimes we've represented them in Social Security disability cases because they're unable to be disabled. So we know a lot of these people as human beings, as our neighbors, long before they became part of a tent city. So we don't think of this as representing a tent city. These are our neighbors that we're representing.
In addition to you and your organization, what are some of the other groups that are advocates for the homeless community?
Well, the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless has been a fantastic advocate here. There's actually a second case in state court, which we're co-counseling with the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless, arguing that the ultimate redesign of this underpass to replace a sidewalk with a bike lane on the sidewalk is intended solely to make sure that homeless people can't ever sleep there again. We believe that that is a violation of the Illinois Homeless Bill of Rights. So that's a separate claim in state court about the ultimate redesign of it.
So bring us up to speed as to the news today, because I've been following this. There's developments, you know, late yesterday and today. And then secondly, what you hope to attain? What's the goal of the lawsuit? Is it to reinstate that area as a place for them to gather with their tents, or what's the goal?
All right, so let me start at the end. The answer is no, we're not trying to get people back under the viaducts. Everybody admits that the viaducts are falling apart, need to be replaced, or need to be repaired. It wasn't safe for the people, and ultimately it's not safe for people who drive over it every day, including myself, because I live in Uptown, so I go over that viaduct all the time. The ultimate goal is to, first of all, protect their right to assemble somewhere that the public can see them, so that the public does not invisibilize the concept of homelessness, which is what the city would like to happen. The second is to provide them with a safe place to gather. While the city is trying to find permanent housing for these folks, they've been trying to do that for 2 years now and haven't succeeded yet. So in the meantime, they're going to live somewhere. And that should be somewhere that's safe, that they can maintain their community, their self-support, maintain access to services that exist in the Uptown neighborhood that many of them are part of already. So that's the ultimate goal of this lawsuit.
So how likely is it, do you think, that you had mentioned that the city's been trying to find housing for these individuals now for a couple of years? It hasn't happened yet. How likely is it, do you think, that they will find housing? And what other solutions has the city posed as an alternative to finding housing?
Well, the only solution the city has proposed is sending people to the Pacific Garden Mission, which is sort of the default shelter in the city. And it's a default shelter because it's not city-funded. It's not city-regulated. It's a religious institution where, for example, in order to get fed, you have to participate in prayer service. In order to be allowed to stay there during the day rather than just at night, you have to participate in their Bible study groups and be part of their entire Bible study program. It's very much a religious institution. It's also very restrictive in the sense that you're not allowed to bring any property with you other than the clothes on your back. So many people, one of the homeless people, in fact, told us that he would prefer to spend time in county jail than at Pacific Garden Mission because the rules there are so restrictive. But you asked earlier what the update is, and I wanted to bring you up to date
on
this.
Yes, please.
As of yesterday morning, they had been told they had to get out from under the viaducts. The city gave them 30 days notice to find someplace else to go. And almost all of them had, in fact, voluntarily relocated outside of the viaduct as of yesterday morning. Then at 11 o'clock yesterday morning, the police came and said where they had relocated to, which was a block to the west of the viaducts, was also illegal. and said if they didn't move, they would be arrested, they'd be ticketed, and their tents would be destroyed. After some back and forth, the residents of the tent city did in fact take their tents down. They were in the park until the park closed, which was about 11 o'clock last night. Then the police made them move out of there. They reestablished the tent city along Marine Drive, just south of Wilson Avenue today, also on a public right-of-way. And they thought that was fine. It was out of the viaducts. It was out of the construction zone, still visible. But then at 11 o'clock this morning, the police came again. This time said you had 15 minutes to get your stuff off the viaduct, off of the property there, or they were going to start throwing everybody's tent away. And anybody who wasn't there, they began throwing them away right away. Ultimately, some people from the community came, said we would help help these people move, and people's things weren't ultimately thrown away. All of them were all the tents were saved. But at the moment, they're sitting back in the park again trying to figure out what they're going to do tonight. And the police were very clear on video saying that, first of all, this was not a safety issue. The police didn't have any problem with this. They had allowed it to go on for a couple of years. And as far as they were concerned, this was not an issue. But they got orders from, and I quote, the city, close quote, to take this action. And therefore, they had no choice. As to what's going to happen tonight, I don't know. They also said, though, that if you go to any place else in the city that's a public on the public property, the same thing is going to happen. We're going to come make you move.
It's kind of ironic that we're talking later today with Professor about Amazon potentially bringing 50,000 employees or hiring 50,000 employees and spending $5 billion to house them. Yet, you know, we're dealing also with a situation where current citizens of Chicago can't find a place to sleep.
There's even a greater irony. Within a block of where they're currently set up is a high-rise development that's going up, luxury high-rise development right on Lincoln Park, so it views over the lake. The city is investing $15 million in TIF money into that luxury apartment without any requirement that they provide any low-income housing on that site at all. So $15 million, that would house all of these people for a very long time. The city has no ultimate solution. And I don't want to think that we're just dealing with a closed set of, you know, 25 or 35 people there. And when we're talking about the viaducts, it's not like there's one group of people and they're the only ones that are there. This city has about 100,000 people who don't have homes. So if they found homes for 50 people, there would be another 50 there the next day. This is a problem which is going to require a reorientation of the way the city thinks about its money. Stop subsidizing things like Amazon or luxury high-rises and start thinking about how we can house the most vulnerable citizens, our neighbors.
All right, that's Alan Mills, the executive director at the Uptown People's Law Center. Thanks for stopping by, and good luck.
Thank you.
Two guests down, two to go here on Legal Face-Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com. Joining us now on the phones, Illinois State Senator Steve Stadelman from the 34th District. He's been in Springfield for 4.5 years, and he joins us now in Chicago. Hello, Senator. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Glad to be here. Thanks.
Senator, thanks so much for joining us today. We're going to be talking about the Right to Yelp bill that you have been very supportive of and actually sponsored here in Illinois. Can you tell us about the Right to Yelp bill and why it is important for Illinois consumers?
Well, it's a bill, and the governor actually signed the piece of legislation. It was approved, overwhelmingly in both chambers this spring, and the governor signed it about a month or so ago. And basically what the new law does, it prohibits so-called non-disparagement clauses in consumer contracts. There have been situations where some businesses inserted these gag clauses in fine print of service agreements that barred people from criticizing products or services online. And as you know, the rise of social platforms such as Yelp, TripAdvisor, and Facebook, this is really a relatively new issue, and people should have the right to voice their opinion.
So federally, there's a law called the Consumer Review Freedom Act that was signed by Obama. That's enforced by the FTC, meaning that consumers can't sue a company directly for violating it. How does this law differ from the federal version?
It's a good question. I haven't actually analyzed the federal law, which was still being debated when I drafted this particular bill, and it was debated in the General Assembly. So I don't have a specific answer for you, but I guess I feel it's important to codify the very same goals in a state law as well.
So I think in that, I think in the state case, consumers, my understanding is that consumers can sue a company for damages and attorney's fees, which I think differs from the federal version.
Right. The state legislation falls under the Illinois Consumer Fraud and Deceptive Practices Act. And if there are violations to the act, plaintiffs could bring suit and try to recover damages. So you're correct. In the state situation, plaintiffs could file a lawsuit.
How big of a problem was this? Do you have any sense as to how often businesses would insert these clauses and would actually take action against consumers who would post negative reviews of them through mechanisms such as Yelp?
Well, there have been several cases that have drawn national attention and which brought the issue to my attention, but I don't think anyone really knows how many companies insert these non-disparagement clauses into consumer contracts or how many customers may have been affected by them. We usually find out about them only after a complaint. But as I mentioned, the issue has arisen in a number of industries, from retail to hospitality. People aren't aware of these contracts. Often, usually found online when customers click that accept button and the terms and conditions, and they may not be aware of what they're clicking on and what the conditions of that contract are.
So there was a case in Dallas of a pet sitting company that sued a couple $1 million after the couple posted a 1-star review on Yelp. The case was dismissed. Companies can still sue for defamation if the review is untrue. I guess one of the obstacles would be proving that the review is untrue, right? In a Yelp situation, for example, it's your opinion, right? I mean, if you go to a restaurant and don't like the spaghetti that you order, you have the right to, you know, give that restaurant a 1-star review. I guess the companies could sue you for defamation if it's untrue, but how do you prove that it's untrue? It's mostly pretty subjective.
Well, that's true. I'm not an attorney, but as you mentioned, libel law is there to take care of businesses who feel that these comments are damaging reputation. They have the right to file a lawsuit for defamation. So that they're still protected under that part. But I think most businesses agree, and the business groups in Illinois did not fight this. I mean, I think they agree there are other measures you can take to deal with this, whether it's to apologize or try to work out the disagreement. But as you stated, you know, people should be able to provide their honest feedback without repercussions. It's a consumer rights issue in my mind. And our whole system of e-commerce depends on consumers providing these truthful reviews that can be shared with others.
Senator, I'm curious, in the in your work on this bill that eventually was signed into law by Governor Rauner, did you have a lot of interaction with was there much evidence that there are fake reviews? You know, I know a lot of business owners allege sometimes that some of the reviews mm-hmm. are fake. And on the other hand, sometimes consumers allege that some positive reviews are not real. Is there any way, as far as you know, from doing this research on this bill, to distinguish whether these reviews are fake or real?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, it's very subjective, so I don't have an immediate answer. But I guess my point is...
Well, I mean more of like, you know, people like a restaurant, for example, posting a review for, you know, the owner of the restaurant, for example, posting the review. Did you come across much of that or not so much?
Well, I guess the point is, again, this isn't necessarily anti-business. I mean, if you're a business, you have ways to counter these negative online posters. You know, businesses can and often do respond online to dispute these comments, or they can apologize for service. I think people respect businesses that try to make amends or try to maybe clarify what the concern is. And if you do business the right way, I don't think you want to be in a position where you're protecting those businesses that don't do things the right way. So I just don't look at this as anti-business.
Senator, no Yelp yet for elected officials, although I guess we could call it the ballot box is the oldest Yelp in the world, right?
No, there'd be no consumer protection for that. I think you pretty much have to accept negative reviews in any elected position, office holder position.
Final question, Senator. How does one go from the anchor desk to state government, because you were an anchor for almost 25 years at WTVO. Yeah. You leave the desk and join politics. How does that work?
Yeah. And it's been chaotic, obviously, the past year or two, as you know. And I, to be honest, I guess I'd be much rather be reporting on the chaos in Springfield right now than being in the line of fire. But I think it's a matter of, I was in the community for a long time reporting on the events, and I felt like I had a good pulse of the community as a journalist. And so you kind of take it a step further and you want to be involved in the decision-making process. You can report the news, but having the ability to change laws and enact legislation that you think will help your community just takes that service a step further. So it's not something, if you would ask me 10 years ago, that I would expect to be doing, but I'm glad I am. But, you know, I've just been in the community for a long time. I just want to take it a step further to try to do things to help the community out.
All right, stay classy then, Anchorman.
Good line, good line.
Senator Steve Stadelman from the Illinois 34th Senate District with us on Legal Faceoff. Thanks again for your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Our final guest on Legal Faceoff for this episode from the University of Chicago Law School, Professor Omri Ben-Shahar, joining us now with Rich and Tina on WGN. Thanks for joining us, Professor.
It's my pleasure.
Professor, we've heard about Amazon is planning to open their second world headquarters, a 50,000-worker facility. They're calling it HQ2. And they plan to spend more than $5 billion to house these employees. Chicago has energetically thrown itself in the mix as a city that wants to lure Amazon, as has understandably many, many other cities. You have some thoughts on the relationship between Chicago attracting these kind of companies and employment non-compete agreements. Could you tell us a little bit more about those thoughts?
Yes, very simply, Amazon wants to hire 50,000 people, many of them in skilled jobs, and they're not going to bring them in buses and trains from Seattle, but rather hire them locally. It's going to be easier to get this workforce and more attractive for Amazon if workers can switch from their existing jobs or wherever they are employed right now and come to work for Amazon. In order to do that, they need to have the freedom to change jobs. That freedom is often limited by what is known as the non-compete clauses or the non-compete agreements that employees sign when they are hired. So to the extent that Illinois enforces these non-competes, Amazon will have harder time recruiting the workforce to their HQ2, their new headquarters, and would be less likely to come to a state like Illinois that enforces such agreements. It is therefore a good idea for Illinois to decide to ban these kind of non-competes. And it just so happens that Illinois took the first step in banning them last year, passing a law, I think it's called the Freedom to Work Act, that prohibits such non-competes, but only for low-income workers, those earning, I think, less than $13 an hour or so. It's time to expand this law and apply it to all labor, skilled labor, especially the ones that Amazon will be targeting. And it turns out that there is a proposal. I so have learned from the governor's office that they have a proposal for such an enactment that would ban all non-competes. And it's just lagging behind in the Illinois legislature. Maybe the Amazon opportunity would give them a shot in the arm and pass this into law.
So, Professor, how likely do you think it is that the governor will be able to get this ban of non-competes through the Illinois legislature? What do you see as the main obstacles to being able to do that?
So, frankly, I'm not an expert in Illinois politics, and I hate to speculate, but I would think that of all the things our politicians are fighting over, this should be relatively easy to agree upon. First, you know, Democrats should love the ban that the government proposes. I understand that they don't like much that the government does, but this is one thing that they can like because it is one of the staples of employee protection. If Democrats see themselves as the party that represents workers, this is an opportunity to show such a commitment. Similarly, Republicans, you know, to the extent that they are committed to free markets and to competition, should hate contracts that restrain movement and freedom of competition. And indeed, all over the country, you can see conservatives and libertarians supporting such laws that ban the restraints on employment competition. So we have an opportunity here to reach a consensus between the left and the right. And it must be that some narrow interests or narrow considerations are stopping this from happening.
Professor, the logic behind non-compete clauses is, you know, fairly simple, that a company, be it an Amazon or another kind of, you know, non-technological company, does not want to spend the time and resources in training someone only to have that person leave not only with that training, but with, you know, trade secrets from that company. Now, lawyers, we, you know, non-competes are not allowed for the legal field for different reasons, but they're very common across the country. Why, in your opinion, for technological companies, is a non-compete not a good idea?
I think you're putting your finger on a very important issue, the question of whether companies would train employees and create more skilled labor if they knew that once the person is fully trained, they can jump ship and go elsewhere. You know, think of a baseball team. Would they train the minor leaguers to become skilled players if they knew that once they, those who are really good, can immediately move to another team? You would think that there would be less training. That is true. And research, social science research does show that companies that have the non-compete protection do engage in more training. But there's a very interesting flip side. Training comes not just from your employer training you, but you as an employee can train yourself by going to school, by spending more, by being more motivated. People who are subject to non-compete have been shown to engage in less of that self-training and self-motivation. And overall, the effect of this lack of self-training is greater than the effect that we see from companies training. So put simply, the bottom line is, without non-competes, we will have a more skilled labor force. Now, companies might lose some of their star workers, but they can go out and recruit star workers from other places. The only thing to worry about is, as you said, trade secrets. Just recently, we heard about a dispute between Google and Uber, Google accusing Uber of stealing a worker who had all the secrets about the development of the autonomous cars that Uber was spending, that Google, excuse me, was spending a lot of money in developing. And that brought to the fore the legal rule that I think is very sensible, and that is, at least in California, Uber can hire away workers. People are free to move, but they cannot take with them the secrets. There is another area of the law that's called trade secret law, and that would protect the company's rights and ownership of ideas and other trade secrets that they have. So workers can move to Amazon if it comes to Chicago, but they cannot take the secrets and the recipes that they have learned in their old workplace along with them.
He's the Leo and Eileen Herzl Professor of Law and the Kearney Director of the Cosandor Institute for Law and Economics at the University of Chicago Law School, Professor Omri Ben-Shahar. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Grab back time on Legal Face Off, WGN Radio, Rich and Tina and Sam. We've got seven topics. We'll start with number one per usual.
Why seven?
I don't know. We've been having seven for a while.
Is that a holdover from the Whiteside era?
It most certainly
seven
is.
Seven kind of works, though, I think, right? After seven people.
It's been a while without a dig. I like that.
Down. Well, and I've tried to make it more than seven, but I've been shot down.
Yeah, too many. You can't have too many. You know, less is more, Tina. You'll learn this. Number one, Attorney General Lisa Madigan here in Illinois announced to the press she will not run again.
Alleged Panayanovich family friend who has yet in 3 years to accept her invite. Now she'll have more free time, though. Maybe she'll come on Legal Face-Off.
She doesn't like bald lawyers, I've
heard.
Yes,
that's true.
I'm not bald.
You know she's running for governor.
Yes.
Well, that's what we were talking about earlier. So Lisa Madigan a very long-serving attorney general here. She's been, I think she's has her, she's in her fourth term.
I think that's right.
Her father, Michael Madigan, is the longest-serving Speaker of the House in any state, and she just a couple days ago announced that she is not running for a fifth term, which brought which was a surprise to a lot of us. She obviously is a rising star in Illinois politics. In the past, has always been talked about as a candidate for a higher office. She has said that she will not run for higher office, in particular the governorship, while her father is Speaker of the House.
You believe that?
I do.
I think so. As a practical matter, I think it would be, you know, very difficult, and having those two people in power would be tough. But maybe now that she has announced this news, maybe he will finally step down. But we want to talk about a list of possible replacements. So everyone literally within minutes of this news has come out of the woodwork. I think anyone who's got a JD after their name is running for this spot. You know, the reason it's such a coveted spot, in addition to being the highest law enforcement position in our state, is that it really is and can be and should be a springboard to higher office. You know, there's a even though Illinois is a very Democratic state, there's been a lack of any Democrat superstars running for a long time. You know, we've seen a Republican governor. We haven't seen a lot of talent coming out of the Democratic side. So a lot of people think that this is a great springboard, not just for the AG's office, but for a governorship, for the Senate, for, you know, future presidential candidates. So people like Kwame Raoul, who's a state representative, has announced that he is looking into it. Everyone from two daughters of Ed Burke, who's one of the more powerful aldermen, to Kim Fox, who's the Cook County State's Attorney, has been mentioned. Scott Drury, who came out very strongly against Speaker Madigan in the past. Lots of others. I think everyone but Tina Martini is looking into it. Maybe even Tina Martini is going to be the candidate for AG.
She's awful quiet.
I was going to suggest that Rich run.
Yes. So, yeah, stay tuned. We're looking to have some of these folks on the show in the future. There has been one person who's announced on the Republican side that she's running, a former Miss America. So we'll continue to watch the story and, again, hopefully have some of these people and his guests in the future.
Let's move to football. Five Wheaton College football players face felony charges. This is after they were accused of a hazing incident back in 2016 when a freshman teammate was restrained allegedly with duct tape, beaten, and left half naked with two torn shoulders.
So, yeah, I mean, huge story, huge trend nationwide. You know, hazing isn't necessarily a trend. We've seen that, you know, literally since people have been going to school. But what is a trend is for authorities to prosecute criminally individuals who are accused of hazing, and also civilly families of victims of hazing, to go after not just the individuals involved, but the fraternities and the schools for damages. Yesterday, the DuPage County State's attorney signed arrest warrants, or actually a judge signed an arrest warrant for five players at Wheaton College, which is a powerhouse in Division III. They're ranked currently fourth in the country in Division III for a hazing incident. As you mentioned, Sam, these individuals are accused of some pretty despicable things. Through a FOIA request, we learned that they tackled this freshman, and he was only at the school for a short period of time. They threw him in a car. They played Middle Eastern music, made offensive comments about Muslims. They took him into a field, actually a baseball diamond, and they threw dirt on him, took his cell phone, left him half naked on the field. He had just transferred to the college, so he didn't really know how to get around very much. It was 45 degrees that night. Found his way back, as you mentioned, required two surgeries, transferred out of the school, and, you know, is saying that this affected his life. We've seen, you know, recently, obviously, the Penn State case that we've covered. That's going on right now. There's a preliminary hearing in the criminal charges against the players or the students involved in the Penn State fraternity hazing. There's an incident involving LSU The Phi Delta Theta chapter was recently suspended after an 18-year-old with a highly elevated blood alcohol level and chemical and marijuana in the system died. There was just another incident at another school. So the point is, this is a growing trend. I think we're going to see more aggressive prosecution criminally of these kind of things, and certainly civilly. I know the parents of Piazza, the Penn State student who died, they were on the Today Show this morning. We're going to see a trend. The question legally, ultimately, is whether this rises to the level of criminal misconduct. And to prove that, you know, they have to prove that there's a causation between what happened and what they did, and also some kind of criminal state of mind. And then the bigger question is whether the overall universities are liable for these incidents.
I would say that this one really was egregious in a couple of ways. I mean, first of all, there was the whole, I would say, hate crime sort of element to it because of the comments about Muslims. And also, there was this whole thing where they, it was almost like a sexual type of abuse to him. And he was found actually next to somebody else, I think. There's some question as to when he would have been found, but for the fact that there was another guy who was dumped right next to him a little while later, whose friends came and took both of them back. So it was pretty awful and egregious.
Sam, you cover sports. Obviously, that's your beat. I started off by saying hazing is not new, right? I mean, hazing's been going on forever. We see it both at the college level and in the pros. You know, certainly not always to this degree. This is certainly, what in my mind, criminal activity. But do you think there's a growing consciousness among athletes that this is, you know, beyond the fray, that this is just out of bounds? Well, how do you distinguish between, you know, normal sort of rookie indoctrination and crossing the line into doing what these athletes are accused of?
Well, and it's interesting you bring that up because, and I don't know all the facts either, and I guess there's a private investigator with this Wheaton case, and the school is still looking into it. I've heard some some allegations that this stuff isn't even true. A lot of the stuff isn't true. So we'll wait and see how it plays out. But hazing is a part of freshman football. Now, to this extent, is it tolerable? Absolutely not. So there is a line to be drawn. But, I mean, they still haze rookies in the NFL. They tape them to a goalpost and throw footballs at them, or they make them dress in drag or something like that. So I've seen that firsthand. This stuff, I never want to see.
I mean, listen, to that point, like Joe Maddon, who's, you know, just won the World Series, who's like a hero in Chicago, who's, you know, world-renowned as one of the great managers, he does hazing once a year. I mean, he gets people, his players, grown men, to dress up as women. Try doing that at a law firm, at a corporation, at this radio station. Try forcing your underlings to dress as women and go on a plane. That's called sexual harassment. That's even called criminal activity. So what is acceptable, apparently, to the world champion Cubs and maybe in Wheaton College and maybe some other places would get you fired and maybe prosecuted, you know, maybe arrested in the real world. So it's certainly a different world.
They say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And in this case, unfortunately, it's true. Jeffrey Sandusky, who's the son of convicted sex abuser and former Penn State football coach Jerry Sandusky, his son Jeffrey has pleaded guilty to all 14 counts of child sexual abuse.
Yes. So last Friday, he pled guilty to all 14 counts of sexual abuse. His trial was actually set to begin this week. The terms of his plea guarantee that he will serve at least 3 to 6 years behind bars, but he may get as much as 6 to 8 years, depending on whether or not the judge decides to impose a stiffer sentence. The charges involved incidents from 2013 and 2016 involving two girls, and these incidents were uncovered last year when one of the girls told her father that Sandusky had been texting her, asking her to send him naked photos. Her father then contacted the authorities, who did an investigation and discovered that there was a second girl involved with Sandusky whom he had asked to engage in sexual acts with him. He apparently used different pretexts with each of the girls to try to get them to participate. In addition to his prison sentence, Sandusky is now a Tier 3 sex offender in Pennsylvania, which is the highest level in the state. And what it means is that he must register with the Pennsylvania police for the rest of his life, and he must verify his registration information in person 4 times a year. This is really sad news. I feel bad for the rest of the Sandusky family. It was already 5 years ago that his father, Jerry, got 30 to 60 years in prison. It was appealed in 2013, and the request for a new trial was denied. He's currently serving his sentence in the Supermax prison in Pennsylvania.
Do you feel bad?
I don't feel bad at all.
Oh, I thought you said you feel bad for their family.
I feel bad for the rest of the family. Oh. I don't feel bad for these two guys, though.
Yeah, I mean,
what about his? What about you know, his mother, for example? I feel terrible for the mother.
Yeah, I guess I feel worse for the victims.
I feel bad. Obviously, I feel the worst for the victims, yeah. But it's very sad.
Kind of a strange family when you think about it.
And this, kind of.
You know, this has nothing to do with what the father was doing, right? I mean, we want to be clear, this is not involving the charges that his father was convicted of, but man.
Yeah, these are independent acts.
Yeah. Would you say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree?
It really doesn't in this family.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's move on to Rich's guy, the farmer bro, Martin Shkreli.
Hey,
Shkreli.
He was my guy a few weeks ago.
Oh. Shkreli.
He's our guy. How about that? He's headed to jail. That's while he awaits sentencing for securities fraud. He put up a post on Facebook where he offered $5,000 for a strand of Hillary Clinton's hair.
Yeah. So we remember that Shkreli was convicted of securities fraud in federal court in New York. He's currently awaiting sentencing, and he was out. A judge allowed him to stay out of jail while he was awaiting sentencing, which was going to take place in January. Well, guess what? Because of this Facebook post, and we know, we've talked about in the past, that during his trial, he was, you know, on social media talking about the trial. He was also talking about the case in the hallways in full earshot of the jury. Well, now he's going right to jail because he, on Facebook, offered $5,000 to anyone who could grab a strand of Hillary Clinton's hair. And because the judge already interpreted his behavior in the past as violent and behavior that the public needs protecting from, and this will certainly, by the way, add years to his sentence or add time to his sentence, Hillary Clinton is a federally protected individual, and you can't threaten federally protected individuals lightly. So the judge sent him right to jail in Brooklyn. He's inmate number 87850-053.
That's an interesting tidbit. Well, and his lawyer apparently claimed that his speech was protected by the First Amendment. And the judge shot back, "This is a solicitation of assault in exchange for money, not protected by the First Amendment."
This guy's such an idiot. And by the way, me saying that he's an idiot is protected by the First Amendment. So
he's an idiot, and the Sanduskis are kind of a bad family.
Rot in jail, Shkreli. And by the way, like, he talked about how it's going to be a great jail. It's Club Fed, he said. You know, this jail has a whole variety of bad guys. I mean, bank
usually
robbers,
usually jails
drug dealers.
Have bad guys, by the way.
Yeah, well, that's true. That is a good point. So, you know, good luck in jail, Shkreli.
Three more to go on the legal grab bag on Legal Face-Off. We start with Wood v. Posner. What's up with Wood?
Not a case.
Yes.
Not a real case.
Not a real case.
Maybe, though.
No, not yet, at least. So, as our listeners know, a couple of weeks ago, Seventh Circuit Judge Richard Posner suddenly retired, with his retirement being made effective immediately. There had been a lot of speculation as to why such a well-known and highly respected judge would retire so quickly and unexpectedly. Well, since his retirement, the New York Times and a number of other publications have reported that Judge Posner decided to step down because of his disagreements with his colleagues over the treatment of pro se litigants. Posner recently said he wanted to give pro se litigants a fairer shake by reviewing staff attorney recommendations about pro se appeals before they were circulated to the other judges.
Pro se is what, by the way?
When one represents oneself.
That's right. For those of us, listeners who don't know Latin, maybe.
Or for your moderator that doesn't
well,
know.
Well, I was going to say, I wasn't sure if Sammy was going to jump in and, you know, tell us all what pro se means.
No idea. I still don't know.
Unrepresented plaintiffs, basically.
Ah, okay.
People who haven't hired lawyers.
That was my third guess.
Well, they are represented by themselves.
Yes. Well, I said haven't hired lawyers.
They've hired themselves.
Yes.
So when asked for her comments to Judge Posner's statements by Above the Law, our, you know, great source for all legal information, Chief Judge Diane Wood stated she disagreed with Posner's position about the quality of the staff attorney's work and the treatment of pro se litigants by the court. And she said that she and the other judges are in alignment that the court takes great care with pro se filings.
But wait, you're missing the most important quote, or are you getting to that? Did I step on? Because Posner allegedly told the New York Times that most judges, not himself, but that most judges regard pro ses as kind of trash, not worth the line.
I was going to leave that out because that was really disparaging.
Hey, listen, that's the news. He said that it's most judges, not himself. Posner didn't say that he thinks this, but he
no,
said
he doesn't.
Most
he said
judges,
everybody else thinks
yeah,
that.
Like, other judges think that pro ses are kind of trash, not worth the time of a federal judge, which is actually not true. Like, I have a lot of cases in federal court, and I have a lot of cases in federal court where there's pro ses. And I'm frustrated because judges don't treat them poorly enough. They bend over backwards to give them every benefit of the doubt. They should treat them not like trash, but like, you know, listen, if you can't prove your case and you're not prepared, get the hell out of here. Instead, most judges, especially in federal court, do bend over backwards to Judge Wood's point to give them every opportunity.
Well,
so,
apparently Richard Posner doesn't agree with
you. He doesn't agree with me, but, you know, in experience, that happens all the time. I have a case right now in federal court, and it's frustrating because you can't move it forward because a pro se is understandably not prepared because they're not lawyers, yet the judge keeps giving them breaks.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, yeah. Rich. But what's interesting is, as some may have heard, Judge Posner actually has a new book out that, interestingly, the release of which interestingly aligned with his resignation. And it's called Reforming the Federal Judiciary. My former court needs to overhaul its staff attorneys and begin televising its oral arguments. That's actually the name of the book. It is going up the charts
that just
rapidly
on
Amazon.
Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? Such a sexy title.
Well, it is number one on Amazon.com under the courts and law section. So
who even knew,
by
the way,
who
even knew that there was a courts and law section outside of
there
the
is, and it's number one.
Martini household? Sasso loves a good legal read, by the way.
He does. He loves a good legal talk, and he doesn't get much of him at home at night, I can tell you that.
I heard he's coming in studio soon.
Sussler
he
is.
The next episode.
You better live up to all the
hype.
I mean, there's been like a year of hype of Sussler.
Actually, a year and a half, 2 years of hype.
Yeah, better live up to it.
Favorite Sussler saying? I thought that's where you were going.
We have to get Judge Posner in. We've been working on it. Stay tuned. We'll get him in. Yeah, we'll get him in.
Two more to go. A Second City actor has sued for discrimination because he was called White Jesus.
Among other things, he was called White Jesus or maybe Jesus, I'm not sure. But Cracker, he was threatened, allegedly. He was threatened, the lawsuit goes, by an African-American cast member at Second City who said that she wished that all white people were dead. She used a, quote, "I hate honkies," close quote, sign on stage as part of the production. But then off stage, she said, "What the audience doesn't know is that I meant that I hate white people." The lawsuit also charges that she threatened to slap the crap out of him and that fellow castmates should shoot him. Second City, of course, has announced that they do not tolerate any discrimination, any harassment of any kind. And they have started posting signs warning that it has a zero tolerance policy towards any kind of hate speech.
It doesn't sound like a fun place to work.
Yeah, not so much. But, you know, listen, it's a comedy troupe, right? So I think there's a line there between what you're doing on stage and, you know, comedy. I mean, listen, the oldest rule in comedy is that there's nothing out of bounds. So once you start suing people for offending you, I think that's kind of a fine line. Of course, no one at any workplace should be threatened or, you know, harassed. But when it comes to the comedy world, you know, there's really the boundaries are a little grayer.
But I don't think any of that was funny. So,
well, you know, funny is
maybe you think it's
funny. Funny is a sliding term. I mean, that's really objective. You know,
Rich,
really,
nothing is funny anymore. There's always something that comes up
that
makes it unfunny. Final thing on
Legal
Face-Off.
Okay, this is really funny. This is undeniably funny.
You never know what we'll cover on Legal Face-Off. And when I saw that we will cover a lawsuit about a monkey selfie,
Rich just put the monkey on his face.
We should get the monkey on the show.
We're working on the monkey.
I bet
he
would give a good interview.
Yeah. I like the monkey's name, too. Naruto. N-A-R-U-T-O. Naruto.
See, you got that name perfectly. That name.
Yes, how is that?
You want to read Naruto's bio? So, Naruto, I understand you have a book coming
Naruto is a monkey with bad teeth.
It's number one on the chimp list on Amazon.
He has better teeth than some people I know, so don't go slighting his teeth now.
I like his teeth.
I think he's cute. And
so what's with the lawsuit?
Tell us all about it.
Yes. So
can't wait.
Naruto the monkey was in a lawsuit that was actually brought by PETA on the monkey's behalf against a photographer. And that lawsuit has finally come to an end after several years. So the battle was between Naruto, a monkey, and PETA, which is People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, brought this lawsuit on Naruto's behalf against David Slater, who was a photographer. The battle started when the very photogenic Naruto decided to grab Slater's camera and started taking selfies. And the question arose as to who owned the copyright in the picture, whether it was Naruto the monkey or Slater, because it was Slater's camera that was used. PETA filed the suit in 2015, and early last year, the judge said that there was no indication that U.S. copyright laws extend to animals. Since the picture was taken, Slater had actually started using the picture of Naruto as part of his personal branding, and it was that act that had actually triggered the lawsuit. So as part of the settlement between Naruto and Slater, Slater agreed to donate 25% of the revenues that are tied to sales and royalties from the picture to a conservation group that works with monkey habitats in Indonesia. Interestingly, both PETA and Slater have asked that the Ninth Circuit throw out the lower court decision, which specifically comes out and says that animals cannot own copyrights. As an IP lawyer, I have to wear the IP hat for at least a second and say that I find it a little bit hard to make the argument that photos taken by monkeys or by any animals would be protected under the copyright law when pictures taken by monkeys are actually one of the specific examples under the copyright law of items that cannot be subject to copyright. Some interesting other examples of things that are not subject to copyright law include murals painted by elephants. So the next time you see a mural painted by an elephant, don't go trying to copyright it. Applications claiming that the Holy Spirit is the author of whatever the work is, as well as claims based on driftwood that has been shaped and smoothed by the ocean. So again, don't start getting creative on the copyright office because they're going to smack you down.
Ooh.
New area of practice for Tina Martini, monkey intellectual property.
All right, don't go monkeying around.
Favorite monkey, Sam? You got to ask this question.
Favorite monkey song or favorite monkey
favorite
movie?
Favorite monkey group.
Well, favorite monkey song. That's a two-parter. So favorite famous monkey and favorite monkey song. For me, it's got to be, obviously, Shock the Monkey by Peter Gabriel. And then favorite famous monkey. I'm not going to go obvious and go King Kong. I'm going to go, maybe the Captain General Zaius, Planet of the Apes. Come on.
Okay, so I went in a completely different direction. My favorite monkey was Davy Jones, Daydream Believer. Favorite monkey song.
Very, very good. No favorite monkey.
My favorite monkey was Davy Jones.
Oh yeah.
With a close second was
Mickey
Dolenz.
Favorite monkey song.
Yeah, Daydream Believer.
Got it.
Mine's probably Stepping Stone, and then my favorite monkey, I actually, look at this, look how fast I call this up.
Wow.
That's the Phoenix Suns Gorilla.
Nice.
Yeah, what's his name?
Suns Gorilla is his name.
Great.
Yes, I have a picture with him too, so.
Another one for the Podcast Hall of Fame right there.
Yes, did I miss anything? I don't think so.
You always miss something. We just can't get into it right
now. Okay, all right, that's Tina. You've also heard from Rich. My name is Sam. Thanks to Craig Collins and to all of our guests. We'll talk to you in October on Legal Face Off.